Mr. and Mrs. Prince, how an extraordinary 18th century family moved out of slavery and into legend. Chapter 1, The Attack. On Tuesday, October 4th, 1785, half a dozen men, later described by the courts as a mob, armed themselves with clubs and crashed through a farm gate and into the Guilford, Vermont house of Abijah and Lucy Prince. Several of the attackers had wrangled with the princes in court, on and off, over small debts and trumped-up transgressions. For months, financed and encouraged by the prince's nearest neighbor, they hounded the former slaves, but the elderly Bijah and Lucy not only refused to be intimidated, but responded to every assault with defiance. Only 5 months before, Lucy had left behind her 80-year-old husband to guard the house while she traveled north to take their complaints to the highest governing body of the independent Republic of Vermont, and she powerfully impressed the governor and council with the first speech they had ever heard by an African American. She returned with an order of protection, but it had no effect against the thugs who were now breaking down her door. They made their way inside, brutally beating the prince's hired man, a mulatto. Bijah and Lucy escaped harm, but the attackers set fire to their hayrick as they raced off. No hay could mean no food throughout the coming winter for the livestock, and therefore no food for themselves, or transportation, or way to make a living. It was likely to mean poverty, starvation, and failure. Others might have given up, but Bijah and Lucy had not faced a lifetime of warfare and the struggle for their own freedom in order to be run off their 100 acres. Instead, they went straight to the authorities and lodged complaints. Within days, arrest warrants were issued for all 6 attackers. One absconded, but the others were locked up, and all eventually ended up before the law, with 3 of the princes and a large number of others subpoenaed to testify against them. The princes, as we shall see, were no strangers to the courts. Had they lived in the South, they would not have been allowed to testify against whites, let alone file charges. So much of how they became who they were depended upon the fact that they lived in New England, a place of contradictions. Slavery was firmly ingrained in the economy and social network of many states, but the principle of legal fair play also prevailed, sometimes awkwardly, alongside enslavement in a complicated world inhabited by Africans, Indians, and Europeans. In the stories about the princes, Lucy always appears as the one who repeatedly acted as a lawyer, but it would turn out that it was Bijah who taught her to pursue her rights through the courts. How did he learn this? To understand that, we begin where his life began, nearly 80 years before the attack, and long before the state of Vermont was even imagined. It was Bijah's luck, or perhaps his misfortune, to enter life in this complex, violent, and troubled part of New England, far from the cities of Boston and Philadelphia, and farther still from the yet-to-be-developed southern plantations. In an interesting historical coincidence, he was born about 300 years ago, in 1706, the same year as Benjamin Franklin, another self-made man who left his home to begin a new life. Their lifespans were almost exactly parallel. Franklin died just 4 years before Prince at the end of the century, but aside from Franklin's eventual opposition to slavery and the fact that they both came of age in Massachusetts, they occupied different universes. Franklin was completely urban. When he left the family home in Boston, he set out for the city of Philadelphia, and he later spent years in Paris serving the American cause. He abandoned his wife for years and was a largely absent father. Bijah lived in the country and in small towns, clearing land and building a house with his own hands, fighting in an earlier war, and devoted to his family. Black and white, rural and urban, their paths never crossed, but they both lived out important versions of a new country. Tradition says that Bijah began his journey in Wallingford, Connecticut, near New Haven, just after the time when the Congregationalist descendants of the Puritan settlers had bought out, killed, or decimated by illness the native population with whom they came to trade. Yet how can one be sure? Although the early New Englanders were meticulous record keepers, if you were black, your name, such as it was put on paper only if you had dealings with a court, if you were bought or sold or inherited, or if you were baptized. If you ran away, newspaper advertisements might describe your height, coloring, and distinguishing features, the clothes you ran off in, and your facility with the English language, since English might be your second or even third language. If you did none of these things, you probably faded into obscurity as another John Negro, or Coffee, or Mary, whose origins or fate seemed negligible, your tastes and your life unremarked. In New England, you were likely to be given a first name that was English or biblical, just as were the whites, but rarely a last name, unless occasionally that of an owner. Abijah Prince's first name comes, like most Puritan names, from the Old Testament and was prescient. One of the biblical Abijahs was appointed by his father to become a judge. Many male slaves were named Prince, but very few from 300 years ago had both a first and a last name. Abijah wore his name proudly, insisting in later years on signing his full name rather than an X on legal documents. He may have gotten his last name from a slave owner, or his father may have been named Prince. Two entrepreneurial ship captains near New Haven, Samuel Prince and Josiah Prince of Milford, Connecticut, had made many runs up and down the Caribbean on their coasters. The owners of this sort of trading sloop often dealt in slaves on a small scale, for themselves or for friends. They carried supplies grown on several Connecticut slave plantations to feed slaves on West Indian plantations, returning with rum, molasses, and sugar, and other products. Armed with nothing but conjecture, a couple of dates, and an eventual master's name of Doolittle, I began far too confidently to try to track down Bijah's origins in Connecticut and headed for the State Library. The Connecticut State Library is a haven for researchers on family history, with some of the most knowledgeable librarians in the field. It occupies the bottom floors of a courthouse in Hartford, protected by stern armed guards and metal detectors. Having written several histories, I was at home in libraries all over America and England. I had researched biographies and thought I knew my way around archives. Yet now, a neophyte among a crowd of family researchers, I found that I knew nothing about the vital records, church records, manuscripts, computer terminals, microfilms, and secondary materials that form the backbone of genealogical research. I had never heard of the Barber or Corbin compilations. Accustomed to the hush of university libraries and the help of reference librarians, I was at sea among the seasoned amateur researchers of their families' pasts, who chatted so loudly and familiarly about their discoveries at the large tables. On a good day, the state librarians try to make up for this array of materials with enthusiasm and knowledge. On a bad day, with genealogists occupying most of the seats and microfilm readers, you're on your own. Somehow believing that no one else had thought to look for Bijah in Connecticut, I sat down to plow through the records. Hours later, I was humbled. There was a black Abijah Prince in the Connecticut census, but he was there in 1790, by which time my elderly Bijah had been living in Vermont for years. There were many black people listed under the heading of Negro with no last name, but the dates and names were similarly wrong. Among the many mentions of other early black inhabitants were the happy but uncommon records of black marriages and the impossibly sad records of slaves being sold or put in their owner's will as property, their lives signed away in the formal and chilly legal language of the 1600s and 1700s. It was a relief not to find Bijah's name there. Knowing from the legend that Bijah was taken to Northfield, Massachusetts by a young Wallingford minister named Benjamin Doolittle, I turned to this family, which began in America with a patriarch appropriately named Abraham, the first of his American tribe. 30 years after the Pequot Wars, in which Connecticut and Massachusetts colonists and soldiers massacred much of that Indian nation and sold the survivors into slavery on Barbados, Abraham Doolittle, or Dowlittle as he spelled it, founded Wallingford, surveying and laying out the new settlement. He occupied a world that remained dangerous, but into which the English never hesitated to expand, and he became its earliest and most important citizen. I was certain that such a prominent early family had left papers behind, and that perhaps the sale of a slave boy might be mentioned in them. A few weeks after my fruitless search to the Connecticut State Library, I drove to the Connecticut Historical Society in suburban West Hartford. There, I made a mistake that I soon learned not to repeat. I told the librarian that I was researching a black man's history. A strange thing happens when you tell some librarians and archivists that you're looking for an African American. They hear that phrase and cannot go past it, separating out black and white American histories as though they were not interconnected. "We have so little on African American history," she said sadly. "I wish we had more. Have you looked at our website?" She checked her computer, only to report that there was nothing in the Doolittle files about black history. With coaxing, she finally produced the Doolittle file, a surprisingly slim folder containing nothing of interest except a highly romanticized history of Abraham, the ancestor of all the Doolittles in America, written by one of his proud Victorian descendants. I made a copy to read at home. I learned that Abraham Doolittle was a Puritan who arrived in Boston in about 1640 with his brother John, just 20 years after the Mayflower landed in America. Men of good sense, courage, and faith, the Doolittle brothers were in their early 20s when they left England, and over the next decades they would be called to public work. John repeatedly held the positions of constable, tithing man, and surveyor in eastern Massachusetts, while Abraham and his wife Joan left almost immediately for New Haven, where he was among the first proprietors, allotted an acre and a half in the new village and more acreage outside of it. Within 2 years of his arrival in New Haven, Abraham Doolittle became sheriff, and from that followed a series of public offices. When plans were laid to found the colony of Wallingford, a dozen miles away on a hill overlooking the Quinnipiac River, Abraham was the man chosen to head the inspection party into a land that was still wooded, full of wolves, moose and deer, and native people. It was not a bucolic place, yet in his vision it was already transformed into orderly squares and rectangles, with a main street running through the middle and a church. As far as the new village and surrounding fields might spread, he knew that the new settlers would always push up against dangers that they did not control, of oppositions between civilized people and savages, between original sin and a striving toward redemption. As time went on, he held nearly every important job in the new community of Wallingford: treasurer, explorer of the surrounding area, surveyor of highways, co-founder of the first church, and selectman. Along the way, he was given more and more land and the rank of sergeant. In 1675, during King Philip's War, he had his house fortified in the usual way, with a wall of 16-foot-tall logs sharpened to points to keep out Indian attackers. He died in 1690 at the age of 70, 15 years before Bijah was born, a man of substance, honored by those in New Haven and in the now prospering town, and revered by his descendants, including the man whose account I was reading. 10 of Abraham's children survived into adulthood. Some of his grandchildren suffered from what they called great weakness and infirmity, but his son John married 3 times in an era when men frequently outlived their exhausted wives. One of John's sons, Benjamin, is at the heart of Bijah's story. Born in 1695 to John's second wife, Mary Peck, Benjamin was a mentally quick and physically able young man educated at Yale. Like the more established Harvard, Yale still had relatively few students, all men, many of them descended from the first settlers, and nearly all of them Congregationalists, and they were taught by tutors scarcely older than their students. The college was in flux, so seniors in his class were allowed to go where they preferred to finish their degrees, and Benjamin chose Wethersfield. Like many of his fellow students, he studied religious doctrine and medicine, for it was common for young graduates to minister to both the souls and the bodies of their congregations. Positions for these young graduates were plentiful, since one of the first desires of those establishing new settlements in western Massachusetts, and what is now known as the Pioneer Valley, which snakes up the Connecticut River into nearby present-day Vermont and New Hampshire, was to convince a clergyman to settle among them. When Benjamin graduated from Yale in 1716, he was asked to try life in a largely unprotected establishment lying north of the older towns of Springfield and Northampton, Massachusetts. A month before he left the calm and relatively cultured safety of Wallingford for the decidedly riskier life of a minister in an area under repeated attack by the French, who disputed ownership of much of the territory, and their Indian allies, Benjamin married. It would take a strong and adventurous woman to embark upon such a precarious life, and he had found just such a one in Lydia Todd, a 20-year-old schoolteacher from a prominent North Haven family. Her parents, Samuel Todd and Susanna Tuttle, were able to provide Lydia with a handsome dowry of £165, an enormous amount in a time when ready money was rare and banks non-existent. Lydia would prove to be every bit as hardy and self-reliant as Benjamin hoped. They married in October 1717 and headed to Northfield shortly afterward, taking with them Bijah, a 12-year-old slave boy, a common gift for a newly ordained minister. As I put down the Doolittle family history, I was speechless. I had just understood an astonishing and wholly unexpected fact. When Lydia Todd married Benjamin Doolittle, a member of my ancestral family became the owner of Abijah Prince.